Chapter 4. Jason, Leia, and Mara relaxed on the living chamber furniture. In the kitchen, Han, maintaining his self-imposed exile, was riding roughshod over C-3PO in the act of cleaning the dinnerware. Luke was alone in the sealed-off communications room, borrowing the Solo's comm gear for some sort of official Jedi business call. Ben and R2-D2 were out on the balcony, matched in a musically noisy but bloodless hologame. Jaina and Zek, too, were out there, but the occasional glimpses caught of them suggested that they were at the railing side of the balcony, watching the endless streams of multicolored traffic flow by in the nighttime sky.
Ben, Mara said, is more open, more trusting.
Her words, directed at Jason, were as much question as statement. Jason nodded, thoughtful, and took a sip from his wine glass. I think he is. He's coming to understand the Force. And people. The fact that he's inherently a bit suspicious of both of them is working in his favor. He's progressing slowly and cautiously. He's not as likely to give in to temptations of the dark side of the Force, or even to teenage hormone rushes. As a small child during the tragic Yuuzhan Vong War, Ben had become fearful and suspicious of the Force, retreating from it despite his own inherited facility with it. Only as Jason's unofficial apprentice had he begun to overcome the emotional damage of that time. Mara shuddered.
Don't bring up the specter of teenage hormone rushes.
Leia snorted.
Not ready to become a grandmother yet?
I think I'd throw myself on my lightsaber first.
Leia smiled.
I think I'm ready. I plan to be the sort of feisty, bad example grandmother who teaches her grandchildren deplorable habits.
She turned her attention to Jason.
How long should I expect to wait?
He gave her an admonishing look. If you're trying to embarrass me, you're talking into a dead comlink.
Not embarrass. I'm just trying to get a timetable.
Ask Jaina. Leia's expression soured comically.
She said to ask you.
Then ask Zek. I'm sure he has things planned out. He probably just hasn't informed Jaina yet. Leia shook her head over her own wine glass.
I have to find some sort of appropriate punishment for Han, for giving our children smart mouths and unhelpful manners. All joking aside, Mara said, Jason, thank you. Ben is doing so much better. I spent years being afraid that he'd never be at home with himself, with his Jedi legacy, with things he could never escape. You've given me reason to think I can stop worrying.
You're welcome. Though, as Mom put it, I have to find some sort of appropriate punishment for you. Mara looked surprised.
What do you mean?
Well, if, as Mom asserts, the smart mouths and unhelpful manners of the Solo children come only from Dad, it means they come not at all from the Skywalker family. Right? So Ben's smart mouth and unhelpful manners have to come from you. I'm going to have to figure out some sort of appropriate revenge someday. Mara grinned, her good humor restored. She tapped the lightsaber hanging at her belt.
Do you have a favorite prosthetics manufacturer? I can pre-order you one.
Jason. Luke stepped into the main living area from the hallway leading to the communications chamber. Care to take a walk with me? Of course. Jason rose. All of them knew that as simple a request as care to take a walk with me, under these circumstances, probably meant time to talk Jedi business. They left through the door that not so long ago Han and Leia had spoken of defending with blaster fire. A dim side corridor led them away from the main access corridor toward an oversized door that occasionally vibrated. Beyond it, though muted, was the hum and roar of Coruscant nighttime traffic. The door lifted out of the way as they approached, revealing a swirl of colors outside. The running lights of flying vehicles, from two-person speeders to small lumbering freighters hurtling by outside, a high aerial traffic lane that passed mere meters from the pedestrian balcony outside the door. As the door slid shut behind them, they paused for a moment at the balcony railing, looking down 200 stories toward Coruscant's ground level. At night, despite the fact that windows on every floor between their position and the ground were illuminated, that advertising signs and banners glowed and gleamed brilliantly, ground level was too dark and distant to be glimpsed. As a child, Jason had once become lost at Coruscant's bedrock level along with Jaina. The depths held no terror for him. Even now, more than 20 years later, they seemed to be a place of mystery and exploration. But it wasn't really the same Coruscant as the one of his childhood. The Vong forming had reshaped much of the world into the Yuuzhan Vong image. Now, years later, huge tracts of what had once been continuous pole-to-pole cityscape still remained black at night, overgrown with fauna, and places like the bedrock levels of the planet and the infrastructure beneath were still home to the crawling and slithering life-forms the Yuuzhan Vong had introduced, some of them deadly. Still, that reminder of the beating Coruscant and the old New Republic had suffered was not visible from this viewpoint. Here it looked like the Coruscant of old, with swirling streams of air traffic, with high-rise dwellings outlined and illuminated by millions of viewports. This balcony ran the length of Han and Leia's building, along a canyon-like drop. Bridges, some of them canopied and some open to the sky or to overhanging skyscrapers above, spanned gaps between buildings. This elevated pedestrian roadway changed appearance, surface texture, and lighting every few hundred meters, intersecting other walkways. Had someone no need to work a job, had he an infinite cred card and feet as tough as Duracrete, he could probably walk entirely around Coruscant's circumference at this altitude. Most of the men, women, and who knew what's traveling this path, Jason counted only 30 or so within 100 steps in either direction, were probably on less ambitious errands. Jason saw wealthy business beings, many of them accompanied by bodyguards, both overt and covert, on strolls. There were young lovers and families, chiefly belonging to the higher income brackets, walking apparently unprotected. Some of them probably didn't worry about the dangers that they might face walking so far from protection. Some were probably better defended than they looked. Luke gestured to the left, where the walkway rose in a series of short steps, some 5 meters across a distance of 50, and they began walking in that direction.
"Your father surprised me," Luke said, "with his mention of Jedi walking the government halls in Corellia."
"Surprised you?" Jason thought about it. "Not because he's being paranoid, because he's not being paranoid. Because there are plans along those lines." Luke nodded, his expression glum. Then he put up his hood and wrapped his cloak more closely around himself, the better to conceal the presence of his lightsaber. Jason did the same. A young human couple pushing a repulsor-assisted baby stroller, trailing 2 dark-clad security men, 1 human and 1 Rodian, were walking in their direction. Luke and Jason would still be slightly conspicuous in their cloaks, which had the anonymous appearance of travelers' garments, but were seldom worn by the sort of people who lived at these altitudes. Then again, the residents of these heights did often go slumming in inappropriate clothes, so they weren't too unusual. Their features shadowed by their hoods, the Jedi passed unrecognized by the oblivious couple and their alert guards. Once they were past, Jason continued.
"It seems like an extreme action. Has the GA given up on negotiation with Corellia?"
"The GA is aware of some facts that haven't made it to the Holocom news feeds," Luke said. "Such as the Corellians aren't really negotiating in good faith, just stringing the GA negotiators along while making no internal effort to edge toward compliance with the new regulations, such as the Corellians are secretly encouraging other systems to follow the same sort of resistance, such as... Luke looked troubled. What I'm about to tell you is for your ears alone.
Understood.
The Corellian government, or someone inside it, appears to be constructing a planetary assault fleet. In secret.
Jason frowned. Historically, there was only one reason ever to build a planetary assault fleet, and to do so in secret. To launch a sneak attack on another system.
For use against whom?
That's a good question, and it's a question military intelligence hasn't been able to answer yet.
Luke shrugged. But there are dozens of possibilities. Most of the recovery loans Corellia made after the Yuuzhan Vong War are in default, and the Corellians have no shortage of trade disputes. They might even be considering a resource grab. There are just too many possibilities at this point to guess.
Why did you say the Corellian government, or someone inside it? Do we not know who's responsible?
Luke shook his head. The truth is, this intelligence is based primarily on analyses of procurement patterns, plus a long history of suspicious personnel assignments.
Wait, the existence of the fleet is based on the reports of accountants?
Luke grinned.
What do you have against accountants?
Nothing, I guess. The problem with the data we have, though, is that it gives us no idea where they're building the fleet, only that it's been under construction for almost a decade, and our logistics people think it's nearing completion.
Jason grew thoughtful for a moment, then asked, And you want me to find the shipyards and confirm the intelligence?
Luke shook his head. I wish it were that easy. Admiral Pelion is confident that military intelligence will soon pinpoint the base. We need you to handle a more pressing matter.
More pressing than a planetary assault?
Yes.
Luke took a deep breath.
The Corellian government is close to making Centerpoint Station operational again.
That stopped Jason where he stood. He stared at Luke, his surprise earning him a nod of affirmation from his uncle.
Centerpoint Station was a relic, an artifact of an ancient civilization that had, in a sense, constructed the Corellian star system. By dragging several inhabitable planets to the system and sending them into beneficial orbits, several hundred kilometers in diameter, bigger even than the Death Stars that the Empire had wielded against rebellious planets decades ago, it had, over the centuries, been the object of internal and external attempts at control by political and military forces that had never quite learned how to utilize it. At the heart of Centerpoint Station was an apparatus that could focus gravity and move planets, or even affect the orbits of stars. It could move them, it could affect them. Used more aggressively, it could destroy them. At times, the Corellians and others had been close to being able to utilize this as a reliable, devastating weapon, but it had for years been restricted by biometric data to operation by only one person, Anakin Solo. The last it had been used was during the Yuuzhan Vong War. After years of being essentially non-functional, it had been brought to operability by the simple realization that it had imprinted on Anakin Solo and could be activated only by him. Jason had argued that it should not be used against the Yuuzhan Vong or anyone. It was too terrible, too unpredictable a weapon. Anakin Solo had argued for it, his reasoning being that its use would prevent the Yuuzhan Vong from destroying millions of lives. Anakin had activated it. Fracken Sal Solo had fired it. Its use hadn't gone well. It had destroyed much of the mighty war fleet of the Hapes Cluster, one of the New Republic's allies. Later in the war, of course, Anakin had died, apparently eliminating the likelihood of it ever being used again. Jason felt a moment of dissonance. His younger self refused to utilize Centerpoint Station. His current self, in the same circumstances, would use it, his qualms having evaporated across the intervening years. The recognition of the changes in himself surprised him. They had crept up on him while he wasn't paying attention. The Jason of more than a decade ago was gone, as dead as the Anakin of the same era was. He took a deep, slow breath and wondered why he no longer mourned either loss. "How have they made it operational again?" he asked. Luke shrugged. "The information we have suggests that they've figured out how to duplicate crucial elements of Anakin's biometrics, probably handprint, retinal patterns, and brainwaves, in the absence of surviving tissues, to pull it off." Jason felt anger swell within him. Use of his brother's identity for such a purpose smacked of disrespect for the dead. There was a ghoulish quality to it he did not appreciate. Still, he recognized his reaction as illogical, irrelevant, so he dismissed it. "And the GA is afraid the Corellians will actually use it as a weapon against them?" "Not directly. Not at first. But if the Corellians use their new fleet to launch an assault against some system, they could then keep the GA at bay with the threat that Centerpoint Station poses. And even if this theoretical sneak attack turns out not to be their plan, Chief Omis is concerned that if the GA continues to enforce its current mandates, the Corellians would be able to use the station to preserve their independence, their autonomy." "That..." Jason stopped before he spoke further. He'd been about to say, "That wouldn't be too bad." But no. The prospect of the Corellians, a notoriously independent planetary culture, possessing the single most potent weapon in the galaxy, and not being obliged to use it for the greater good of galactic civilization, in fact, being able to use it to assert their own agenda, would be bad. Very bad. He let his mind drift for a moment into the future, into one possible future, one most likely to result from the actions Luke was describing, and caught just a vision of vast fleets at war, of planetary surfaces suffering bombardment, of brother and sister firing on each other. The brief glimpse turned his stomach. "So the Galactic Alliance is calling on the Jedi Order." Luke nodded. "More specifically, Admiral Pelion sees outright rebellion across many star systems as a direct consequence of continued inaction by the GA. Several of his computer-modeled outcomes point that way, as apparently his instinct does. Other admirals he's consulted agree, and so Cal Omis has signed off on this plan." Jason took a deep breath, considering. Admiral Pelion, for decades the leader who had kept the Imperial Remnant proud, independent, and ethical, had been chosen as Supreme Commander of the Galactic Alliance a few years earlier, sure sign of the Imperial Remnant's growing status and importance within the GA. If he saw continued Corellian reticence as a sure path to civil war, Jason would have a hard time arguing with that conclusion. "So what's the plan?" Luke circled in around his answer. "Among the scientists and support crew who have been studying Centerpoint Station for Corellia, there are GA spies, of course. They would have a very hard time smuggling in squadrons of elite soldiers to damage or disable the facility. One or two infiltrators they could manage, and packing squadrons' worth of effectiveness into one or two people means Jedi." "Yes." "What do you want me to do?"
"Travel to Centerpoint Station and disable or destroy it."
Jason tapped the hilt of his lightsaber. "Disable or destroy a moon-sized installation with just what I can smuggle in?"
"Others have been destroyed with just a proton torpedo and the right knowledge.
We'll try to get you the right knowledge, and the GA will be initiating an operation elsewhere in the system that should attract the Defender's attention. Will you do it?
Yes, of course. But why me?
A few reasons. First, unlike most Jedi, you've been there. Second, because of who raised you, you can put on an authentic Corellian accent when you want to. That and the fact that you've inherited a bit of the Corellian look from your father will make it easier for you to move unobtrusively through the installation. Third, your specialized training in alternative philosophies of the Force makes you more versatile than many other Jedi, than some Jedi Masters, in fact, making it harder to stop you.
And what about Ben?
Luke was silent for a long moment.
He and Jason turned onto a bridge spanning the chasm between two long rows of skyscrapers. It was made of transparasteel embedded with brightly colored sand and gravel, its railing high so that the occasional ferocious gusts of wind that coursed through Coruscant's Duracrete canyons would not toss a pedestrian over the side. Pedestrians could look down through the transparent surface beneath their feet into the 2 kilometer depths below them, and they felt the slight sway of the bridge as a gust of wind pushed it. 12 meters down, a stream of traffic coursed by like a river made of multicolored lights. Luke's tone was impassive, artificially so.
That is a matter for you, as his teacher, to decide. Even on dangerous missions, Jedi Masters often took their apprentices. It was how those apprentices learned. Sometimes the apprentices died with their teachers, and Luke had considered the question of whether Jason should take Luke's own son and put the decision entirely on Jason's shoulders. Luke had responded as a Jedi Master should, not letting his relationship with the apprentice in question cloud his judgment. Jason would have to do the same. Ben was bright, inventive, and largely obedient. At the flip of a switch, he could act like any precocious 13-year-old, as un-Jedi-like as it was possible to be. He'd be an asset on a mission like this.
He'll come with me.
Luke nodded, apparently serene in his acceptance of Jason's decision.
It's going to get ugly when this happens, Jason continued. The Corellians, this is going to infuriate them.
Yes, but the other part of the operation, which is in part distraction for your mission, is a show of force. All of a sudden, an entire GA fleet will materialize within Corellian space. Between that and the loss of Centerpoint, military intelligence thinks the Corellians will realize that they can't continue to adopt a we-do-whatever-we-like stance. Jason shook his head.
Whose brilliant idea is that?
I don't know. It was presented to me by Cal Omis and by Admiral Neothel, one of Pelion's advisors.
She's Mon Cal, not Corellian.
Well, she indicated that the psychological warfare experts had evaluated the Corellian planetary mindset and were certain that this operation would have the desired effect, assuming the destruction of Centerpoint Station was effective. Jason snorted.
What do you want to bet that they based their evaluations on old data, pre-Vong War data, maybe even Dictat era? I don't think they've factored in what surviving the war did to the Corellians. It stiffened their pride.
I'm sure they're using up-to-date information. Regardless, that part of the operation is one I don't have any influence on. It's going ahead regardless of the opinion of the Jedi Order. Luke's expression was still serene, but Jason detected a flicker of regret. Let's get back.
I think I'll walk a while longer, settle my thoughts, figure out what I'm going to say to my father when the time comes.
Don't overplan.
Luke clapped Jason on the shoulder and turned back toward Han and Leia's building.
The future is to be lived, not prearranged. As he reached the door, providing access into the Solo's building, Luke felt a little tickle of awareness, as though someone had materialized just behind him and brushed him with a feather. He turned to look. No one actually stood behind him. But across the avenue, perhaps 30 meters away, standing on a pedestrian thoroughfare at about the same altitude, someone was watching him. His watcher stood a few meters away from the nearest light source, wrapped up in a traveler's cloak not dissimilar to the outer garments he and the other Jedi wore. Its hood was up, and the garment masked the wearer's build. Luke could tell little more than that the wearer was of average height or taller and looked lean. But something in this being's posture reminded Luke of the image from his dream, and caused him to wonder if the watcher had features similar to long-dead Anakin Skywalker, with eyes turned a liquid yellow by anger and Sith techniques. As Luke watched, the watcher turned, walked the few steps to the nearest doorway into its own building, and entered, vanishing into darkness. Luke shook his head. He could go over there, of course, but it would take time, and he'd find nothing. Either the watcher was unrelated to Luke's dream, or it was someone deliberately making contact as a warning or greeting. Either way, no evidence would remain. Luke entered the Solo's building. After all the guests were gone, most of them returning to quarters at the Jedi Temple, and the Solo quarters were dark, Han and Leia lay wrapped in each other's arms in their bedchamber. That chamber was against an exterior wall of the building, just below the pedestrian walkway outside, and featured a broad, transparent-steel viewport that afforded them a view of the traffic lanes outside, or, if Han and Leia were close enough and ducked low enough, of the skies. It was a much thicker plate of transparent-steel than most dwelling viewports featured, as was appropriate to a former chief of state and her equally famous husband, either of whom might become the target of assassins or kidnappers. It was armor suitable to a naval vessel, and one of the more expensive features of these quarters. But it was as clear as any more ordinary viewport, and with the blinds opened, they could watch through it the endless, brilliantly colorful streams of traffic.
"You were pretty hard on Zek," Leia chided, "all evening long."
"You think so?" Han considered. "I didn't challenge him to any drinking games, or ask him about all his failed relationships."
"Good."
Leia nodded against his chest.
"But you could have been nicer."
"Nicer to the man who's chasing my daughter around? What sort of example would that set? I'm her father. Besides, he's taking advantage of her."
"That's ridiculous."
"No, listen. Since she doesn't believe that he's after her, since she's maintaining her we're just good friends despite anything that might have happened before self-delusion, he can stay close and operate without her being aware of it."
"He's a good boy."
"Where my daughter is concerned, nobody is a good boy. Besides, nobody that tall should be referred to as a boy."
"Well, if she likes taller men, it's probably a preference she picked up from her upbringing."
"Oh?" Han considered. "You think she's more comfortable with taller men because of me?"
"No, because of Chewbacca."
Han looked down at her. A sliver of blue light crossed over the bed and illuminated her eyes, which were open, her expression somehow both merry and artificially innocent. Chewbacca, Han's Wookiee co-pilot and best friend, had died more than a decade ago, at the onset of the Yuuzhan Vong War. After that, it had been years before Han could hear or speak his name without feeling a stab of pain in his heart. Now, of course, there was still sadness at his loss, but with it were years of more glad memories.
"You," Han said, "should not mock Han Solo, hero of the galaxy."
"I would never. I was mocking Han Solo, meddling dad, and supreme egotist.
Now you're in trouble. She laughed at him.